Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
So, first of all, to really celebrate that adolescent is the heart of medicine, we have Russell Viner. Russell Viner is our wonderful RCPCH president. He's also an adolescent and diabetic pediatrician working at UCH. And he is also born in Bruce Rock from outback Western Australia. He's an Australian refugee hiding from the weather. So, Russell Viner.
Thank you very much. Well, good morning. Have we got any adolescents in the audience? Any adolescents in the room? Apart from Zia at the front here. Good to see you. I suspect the adolescents are probably still sleeping in after last night. So, my job is to convince you, actually, that this is not about the twilight, that adolescents really need to be at the heart of pediatrics and thinking about where our upper age range goes to. So, metamorphosis was the title, so I couldn't resist putting up the slide of this German anthropologist, Ernst Haeckel. I kind of love the pose. I wish I could get my college portrait done like this, maybe later in life. He had this idea that phylogeny recapitulates ontogeny without going into details. He saw adolescence as the monkey stage of human life, that we started off as fishes or salamanders, and the children were like kind of lower animals, and that adolescents were like apes, and then they evolved into humans. So deeply dodgy kind of ideas. We don't believe any of that stuff these days, fortunately. But young people from 10 to 19, if we want to take a WHO type of definition, or 10 to 25, if we want to think about an expanded version of adolescence, need to be in our thoughts in many, many ways. They challenge us in our emergency departments. They challenge us in our clinics in pediatrics. And in fact, the great epidemics of the modern world, mental health and obesity, are manifest most in our young people. So they're a real challenge to traditional pediatrics, and I want to talk through where we think we're going. But first, a quiz for you. If you want to, hopefully you're up for the polling. What age do you remember thinking you were no longer a child? Okay. One person responded thus far, maybe everybody. Aha. So we watch the polling shift. So some a bit earlier, some much later. No one's going 10 to 12, that's interesting. We're sort of stabilizing here. So I think we've got a range, and that's the most important thing, is that it's very personal. I could ask you when you thought you were going to be first an adult, but I won't. So look, a huge range there. And some, maybe that's two people right at the bottom there. Okay, next question. What age do girls start puberty in the modern world? And I'm talking about high-income world here. I'm talking about the UK, Australia, wherever else. Best guesses. So we're quite a majority, haven't we, going for 10 years of age. Interesting, that's a bit early. But we'll come back to that maybe on the next slide. Okay, first thing to say is the world has changed, not just in the UK, but all over the high-income world and all over the lower and middle-income world. Let's think about adolescence in the 1950s. This could be Australia, the UK, New Zealand, even the US. Average age of puberty, or starting periods for girls, which is the end of puberty, was around 13. Average age of getting married was 18, and first child usually around 9 months exactly after getting married, for obvious reasons. Adolescence was constrained by these bounds. marriage and childbirth are social control mechanisms. It's not that they ruin your life, but they make you settle down. They are social control mechanisms. They make you grow up. So the modern world, what do we have? Minimal change in puberty. There's probably been some pulling back of puberty, but very little in high-income countries. Very much, of course, in lower- and middle-income countries. Marriage, 50% of people in the UK get married, so only half. And childbirth now comes well later. So average age of first child in the UK is right up to about 32, 33. So if we think of adolescence as the period between biological capacity, the ability to do things, and social control, adolescence has gone from being 4 years in the 1980s out to this incredibly long period where we don't have social control mechanisms tethering our behavior. And that has much to do with the explanations of the evolution of mental health problems in young people and a whole range of things. But we shouldn't just think of this in a problematic way, but of course this is freedom for young people to fulfill their potential, be who they are. So health takes on a whole different range of ideas here. Any idea of the average age for people to leave home in modern Britain? And of course, interestingly, many of them leave home and then come back. But this is leave home for the first time. Okay, the answer, actually, you were getting it right. The answer is 24 to 25. And actually, many countries across Europe, it's even higher. Interesting. I want to argue to you that there's a unique science of adolescence, which is important for us in pediatrics. But the demography means that we need to think about young people differently. The demography and the need. There are as many teenagers in the second decade of life as there are children in the first decade of life in the UK, and that's true for most high-income countries. So there are as many teenagers as there are children. We can no longer have standard pediatric assumptions that there's a whole lot of children and not so many teenagers. I can't show you today, but burden has shifted from childhood into adolescence in the modern era. Burden across childhood used to be concentrated in the under fives, then get less, and adolescence was the healthiest time of life, the time of life when we were fittest and strongest, best looking, most fertile, most lustful, and most ambitious. And it still is many of those things, but it is no longer the healthiest time of life. The healthiest time of life is now between 3 to 4 through to 10 to 11 years of age. That is when hospital usage is lowest, healthcare usage is lowest, chronic conditions are lowest, and kids have really good well-being. And what we see in the pediatric age range is burden has shifted right down into the under ones, a bit to the under threes, and shifted into adolescence. And young people are suffering from a whole heap of new conditions, morbidities that come from change and economic and social change in the world. So adolescence, I'll come back to that in terms of health service use, but actually there is burden has moved into adolescence and out of childhood. And what we can't do is continue to build pediatrics based on 1950s models, which are all about the under fives. We'll come back to that. There is a unique science of adolescence. Human puberty is unique. No other organism has a 5-year variability in the timing of onset of puberty in healthy individuals. No other animal, potentially apart from chimpanzees, but we're not sure, has adrenarche, which is the turning on of the adrenal glands. There's little glands that sit next to the kidneys that produce a range of hormones and adrenaline, turning on of the adrenals from about age 7 to 8 onwards. We don't know what adrenarche is for, but it has clear impacts on behavior. Humans are the only animals that have major CNS development at the same time as puberty. No other animal, even the highest apes, have that. And humans are the only animals that actually have a significant growth spurt during puberty. In all other animals, your dog, your cat, whatever, growth is dissociated from puberty. In humans, they're coupled. So there is a unique science of adolescence. More than that, the great discovery of neuroscience over the last 20 years has been about adolescent brain development. We used to think that brain development was largely over by the age of 3. We used to say things like, show me the child by the time he is 7 and I will show you the man, that old Jesuit idea. The idea that it's all about the under 3s, that it's all about the first 1,000 days, that it's all about adverse childhood experiences early on. And those things are very important, but it is not all about them. The idea that brain development stopped at 3 came from postmortem studies, which for ease looked at the occipital lobes of the brain, which have the largest neurons, the easiest to study, and are about sense organs, particularly vision and others. And those things are largely over by 3. But actually, the thinking bits of our brain, the frontal lobes, and the intersection with the temporal lobes, the discoveries have been that there are major developments of those lobes from 10 through to 20. That the human brain gets its largest volume and largest gray matter by age 10, and then waves of synaptic pruning run through the brain and make us think faster in a whole bunch of ways across adolescence. So we get cleverer and we think differently. This is really important for abstract thinking, the development of identity questioning, and the questioning that we see in adolescence. And adolescence, in many senses, is the combination of very biological brain development and the development of the ability to question yourself and others, to explore behaviors, to think about yourself by standing outside yourself and looking in. The interaction of that with social change and with bodily change, puberty, completion of height development, and there is development every single organ in the body. There's a lot of development across the liver, across the heart, across the kidneys that we ignore. And it is strange. We pediatricians make the argument that children are not just small adults as the basis for pediatrics. And we base what we do on the physiology of childhood. Yet we treat adolescents as small adults or as just big children. And we neglect the fact that there is a specific immunology, physiology, pharmacology, pharmacokinetics, and many other things of adolescence that we ignore. Now, you've seen this slide. I love this slide. This is such a young person being an adolescent. You might recognize the lady in the hat. For those who don't, she's an elderly lady, lives in a big house just up the road here. This is the same lady who's obviously learnt something from the first photobomber and is photobombing a couple of Australian adolescents who are competing at the London Olympics. So I love those two slides. So you even can learn in your 90s, I suspect. Anyway, the other thing about adolescence, initiation of behaviours. No one starts smoking after the age of 18. Nobody at age 25 says, haven't tried it yet, but I think I'll take up smoking. I fancy a fag. Same with alcohol, and the same with sex. So if you're over 25 in the audience today, and you've not had sex yet, the chances of you starting are not very high. So perhaps you better get on with it, if you want to. And I don't see anybody rushing for the aisles. But the point being, if we think about smoking, prevalence of smoking at age 10 or 11 is about 0.3%, and it's as high as it ever gets by 18. There are windows of opportunity, and it's not just health behaviors and injuries and a whole range of things. This is about how you control your diabetes, how you do all of those other things in life. Okay. The age of onset of mental health problems. I want to show this slide very quickly just to show that the main age of onset of mental health problems is during that 10 to 25 period. The idea is that moving parts get broken, that there is so much development during adolescence that it brings pathology. The two great developmental periods of the human life course are the under ones, the interuterine and under ones, and early to mid to late adolescence. And moving parts get broken, development causes pathology. and we neglect that. How can we have an age of pediatrics that goes up to 14 or 15 or 16? The age at which you stop walking away from a cradle and start walking towards a grave is probably age 24. That's the tipping point for development. And if pediatrics is developmental medicine, it's difficult to argue that it should not go up into the early 20s. So, which two groups are the largest users of ED services in the UK? Any ideas? The elderly, the middle-aged, the very young? So you're all wrong. The answer is D. Okay. Peak ED use is definitely, actually it's the under ones particularly, and really tails off after that, and as you know, and then peak ED use is 15 to 25. And actually it's a bigger group than the under ones. ED use by the frail elderly is very low. They just have a lot of transition into staying in hospital, but actually numbers that come to ED is low. Okay, let's move on. Health service use increases during adolescence. I think I've talked about that already. I want to tell you a story. A young person, this is Emma, who is 14. She has type 1 diabetes. Her glycosylated hemoglobin is 14. Anybody know whether that's good or bad? What are we hearing? Bad. It's like terrible, isn't it? She doesn't ever have hypos. She's never come into hospital with DKA. What do we need to do for her? Thoughts, please, on your poll. Ooh. We've got 1D, good. Get a haircut, get a real job, sort yourself out. I'm loving it. I'm loving it. Did I telegraph the answer to this? We need to get behind her eyes to understand. So Emma has an HbA1c of 14. That means she has guaranteed diabetes complications in 5 years, if that continues, almost certainly. What is she doing? She has stunning control of her diabetes if we get behind her eyes. From a medical sense, of course, it's terrible. But if I got diabetes tomorrow, I could not manage it in the way that she does, which is she does no blood sugars. She senses what her blood glucose might be. She does no blood glucose testing. She knows exactly how much insulin to have and exactly how much insulin not to have to keep herself with high blood sugars but not go into diabetic ketoacidosis. That is an incredibly skillful thing to do. She doesn't need re-education, she doesn't need social services, she doesn't need psychology. She needs us to get behind her eyes and understand why she's doing what she's doing and help her to achieve her priorities and get her to see what the medical ones are, which is, this is the Janus face, looking two ways, recognizing she both has appalling control and stunning control. Because if you ask the postmodern question, whose control is it and what is it for? Control of disease in adolescence is about having a good life. It's not about the future. And we have to get her to see that other side of control. So you need to be postmodern doctors in that way. So I'm really glad you gave me that answer. And so maybe I'm preaching to the converted. But it's that recognizing that she has very careful, poor control. And many of the adolescents that you see in a whole range of places will have careful, poor control of their chronic conditions. And that's why they present in different ways. So I'm going to stop there and say, what are the key messages? Burden has shifted to adolescents. We cannot neglect them in pediatrics. They have to be the heart. There are classic ways that I don't have time to talk to you about today, and wasn't going to, about how we communicate with young people. But we absolutely need to get inside their heads and understand their priorities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Russell. I certainly found some of those statistics and pollings really educational.
So we might take a question from the audience, so have a little think and put your hands up and one of our roving mics will go. We've got a few questions on Twitter as well. If you've got questions all throughout the keynote, please tag at Danny Hall Tweets. It's also written in your conference program and on the slide above. So Danny, what have they got to say?
Okay, so the first question is from Chris White, and he says, if adolescent medicine is the area of pediatrics that has the highest burden, should we be investing in specific adolescent wards to provide effective adolescent care?
Oh, well, look, I think so. I mean, there are many hospitals across different countries that focus on young people. Many pediatric services have babies wards because they think the needs of babies are rather similar. It all depends whether we think the needs of the person outweigh the specialist nursing or medical needs. Do we split by specialty, have respiratory wards or orthopedic wards, which is around the doctors and the nursing skills, or do we split it around the needs of the patients? I know what I believe. And I think it's very interesting that we say intensive care, it's the overall needs. Infectious diseases, we throw out all the ideas about, you know, infectious wards. We throw out all of our specialist nursing ideas, but we don't tend to do that for young people. I think we should.
Good.
We've got a question from the floor.
You mentioned the sort of the end of pediatric services and that transition into adulthood. Do you feel that there should be a more sort of national view on when pediatric services should transition to adulthood? Because there's a currently vast variation throughout the country.
There's extraordinary variation, and it's to the detriment of our patients. In the NHS, the National Health Service in England, has a new long-term plan. We in the College of Paediatrics Child Health were very involved in pushing on that. We pushed with others to get the idea of 0 to 25 services into that plan. So all mental health services for young people, we commissioned 0 to 25 with an ambition that physical health services are also commissioned. That does not mean that paediatricians will be seeing 25-year-olds. What it means is that if you're planning a health service, it is should be impossible to plan that without thinking 0 to 25, planning where paediatrics and adult services interdigitate and end. And I think personally that that can be done in a multiple different ways if you've got brilliant adult colleagues, but I suspect inexorably our age ranges will go up, as they have done in the US and in other places. As adults get drawn ever older by the ever-increasing frailty of the ever-increasing elderly, they get pulled away from us.
Thank you for the talk, it was excellent. I'm quite curious, actually, because I'm an emergency physician and a pediatric emergency physician, and adolescence is something I'm particularly interested in. And I wonder if there is a space for RCPCH and ORCHEM actually having subspecialty in adolescent emergency medicine, because certainly where I work is very adolescent and young person heavy.
Yeah.
And it's, I feel it is my job to be the adolescent specialist, which I'm very happy to do, but I would like to be better trained. And I wonder if there's something that you and ORCHEM could work on together to improve our emergency services for adolescents and young people.
I mean, I think there's quite a lot of thought around some of this, and happy to talk more with ORCHEM and Taj and the new president coming in. I'm a lumper more than a splitter, and you know, being through this in much of my life, I think I would rather get all of pediatrics focusing as much on adolescents as it is on the younger, rather than develop new areas of specialities. However, I recognize we need some people trained up more. So the idea of special interest models, credentials, whatever they're called in adolescent work, is what I would be arguing for, rather than some new subspecialty, if that made sense. But I agree with you.
We've got a lot of questions from Twitter, so to give credence.
What I might do is I might give you two in one, if that's okay Russell, because one's a question and one's a question on the question. So, Edward Snelson asks, what do you think that frontline clinicians should be doing when we see an obese child or adolescent? And that's followed by Joseph Machter, who says, great question. Should we really use every point of contact as an opportunity to educate on their weight, or do we just risk alienating them further if it's already a source of anxiety and anger?
Aha, okay. So I didn't talk about obesity, but happy to take questions. Number one, we must take every opportunity to make every contact count. There's good evidence from the adult literature that simple 30-second interventions by GPs can change the weight trajectory in an obese adult. We don't have that data in kids, children, young people, but we know we should be doing that. There's actually good evidence that it's pretty easy to just change your language to be able to raise the subject of obesity with somebody and then signpost. It's not the pediatrician's job to be treating obesity mostly. Some people need to do more of it. But what we need to be doing is recognizing, making children and young people aware, and signposting. So I absolutely think we should be.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Russell.
Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!